Welcome to the fourth guest on the Shut Up and Ride podcast, sponsored by our wonderful, lovely Charles Owen here at the Ligon Arms in Broadway. Obviously, Simon and Ben are still here. And I don't think the three guests before will mind me saying that the legend, like, that we've kind of been waiting for. Like, we talk about her on the podcast all the fucking time. She hasn't listened to it. She won't know how much we talk about her. She is, I just literally, I have so much love for you. It is unreal. You are a legend. You are adored by all. The wonderfully brilliant. Please give it up for Lucinda Green.
Really, I think it's kind of my
love. Listen to them. They love you. I kind of am a bit nervous because I know you as a friend. This is how lovely Lucinda is. I ran into her in Maryland. I was so excited to see her. And she was like, I need to make sure I save your Canadian number under your name. And she was like, put it in. Here you are on my phone. Put your number in. And I looked at what she had me saved under in her phone. And it was Jenny Rudel, Gregor, James and Delilah. She Aww. Saved my husband and my kids' names so she always could remember them. And I was like, that is Lucinda. You are just the kindest. You are always, you never forget about asking about my horse. You've messaged me at 3 o'clock in the morning, which I have to say is sometimes slightly weird. But you're like, so Jenny, how was it at Tweedledown that weekend? Did he go all right? And I'm like, Jesus, Lucinda, the amount of people you teach, work with, how the hell are you remembering me on my novice horse going round?
And it's not just one off. She's done that with me as well. Like, she's... I've been at 3-day events when it's gone really, really well, and she's come to find me in the stables and say, bloody well done, you did a brilliant job today. And there's been other ones where it's gone terribly and no one wants to talk to me, and there's Lucinda saying, yeah, it didn't go that great today, how can I help? And then messages at 3 a.m. saying, I've been thinking about it. Maybe we should meet up and have a chat about it.
I might have a bit that you could try.
It's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, it can't just be us two.
Yeah, like... is it just us?
It's really
good,
by the way.
Is it? Oh, well, Gemma.
Gemma's not,
like,
exactly.
You have a... Don't get me wrong, you've shared your opinions with me as well on things. But you just are such a legend of the sport. Thank you so much for coming on. Like, I messaged you and you were like, yeah, I'll be there. Keep reminding me.
Yes, that's a problem.
And then, obviously, Ben, had you ever heard of Mr. Atkinson and his Liberty ways?
I absolutely had heard of Ben Atkinson, but I don't know anything about what he does. Liberty, to me, means... I haven't got a picture in my mind what Liberty is, so I just knew Ben.
Yeah.
He did a lot of stuff, and I'm thrilled to meet you, and I can see the passion burning out of your brain. I love it.
And do you like the fact that, like, obviously we've teamed up in this podcast. When you have this amalgamation now of, like, embracing the different disciplines and how everyone else works and the Liberty training, when you hear the fact that we're working with someone who does the Liberty, does that kind of, do you go, oh, that's exciting, I want to learn, or are you like, oh, no, I'm no interest?
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I absolutely love what I see on the odd, I can't remember all their names, which is awful, but there's a wonderful Frenchman that came to Chatsworth and then often ends up in London and does different things. And I've watched him train in the morning at Chatsworth, and I just think it's absolutely phenomenal, and it bugs me that I absolutely am nowhere near being able to do any of that. So I loved what I heard about Richard's son in that last pod, that he was riding around the outdoor arena and Richard was in the indoor with no bridle on, and Richard was saying, what are you doing? I love that, because that's what life is all about and horsemanship is all about. It's about trying things and seeing how a horse works. And that lovely thing that Andrew McLean is going to do in the middle of February, a webinar, how a horse thinks. I'm intrigued because he's really brilliant. And anything, any information from somebody like that, or somebody like you, Ben, who spent so much of your time helping horses understand what you want. It's amazing. I love it. But I don't think I'm ever going to get there.
I just love the fact that you're saying that. You don't think you're ever going to get there. Like, I have a feeling if you wanted to learn something, Lucinda, that you would. But I've always felt like you... Whenever, I don't know, sometimes I think like you've always been like streaks ahead as well in some of the ways you think. Like, I remember you telling me about the fact that you're like, oh, no, I don't wear boots, I don't wear bandages, they overheat tendons and everything, and your philosophy on that. And then suddenly now we're seeing science out about how boots and bandages are. And I was like, I remember Lucinda talking to me about that 20 years ago. Like, you just seem to be constantly evolving and learning. you, unbelievably. Is that a conscious thing? Do you seek it out, or is it just something that kind of like you just stumble upon it as you're going?
I think I'm incredibly lucky that I've got a very inquisitive mind, and it drives people nuts because I'm always saying, but why do you do that? Little tiny things like the unintended consequences of overreach boots or bell boots. And I stopped wearing those 25 years ago because bad accidents have happened when horses have done that for a split second. And in fact, somebody lost his life in Portugal in front of a V-fence because that happened at the moment of takeoff. And so I've always worried about unintended consequences. Just the other day I learnt that the FEI have stopped, in their wisdom, two stops on the reins for a martingale. Now, if anybody ever rides in a pair of reins that have rubber on them, they know that sometimes the running martingale will run down and get stuck where the rubber joins the leather. So I always used to put a stop there in front of the rubber, and they couldn't get stuck. Now I'm told that's illegal. And I imagine it's because somebody's worked out that if they stick the martingale stop so that they can't move, they get more emphasis on the horse's jaw or something because the martingale is nearer the mouth. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure that's an unintended consequence. But I this is what I find fascinating, all these rules that come flying out. And I'm thinking, God almighty, it's all very well doing that, but what happens if that happens because of the rule that you've made? Drives me nuts.
I think the thing, I'm going to pass it over to the boys. I could just ask you questions all night, to be honest, and I probably will. One of the things I've been taught, I've been so lucky to be taught by you on so many occasions, and I love your lessons so much. I love how much you challenge me. I love how much you push me. I love the fact that half the time I'm like, I have no idea where she wants me to fucking go, but I think there's a line there and I'll find it.
That's about right.
Yeah. But what I also love is, and what I live by, is if the horse doesn't understand the question, he won't be able to give you the answer. And like, just being like, do I know what the question is? And that is what I live by. And I told Ben this on one of our podcasts, and he just went nuts for it, didn't you? You loved that idea of, if you don't know the question you're asking, don't bother asking it, or make sure you know it before it. And Ben, that resonated with you massively, didn't it?
Oh, so much. Because that, like, a thing, if I'm teaching a ridden lesson, is if I can see a person moving a hand or a leg or something, I'll often say, okay, stop. What are you asking for with, you know, that left hand or with your outside leg? And there is no wrong answer, because even if they were giving an aid, they actually won't get what they want. But as long as they've got an answer, then at least we're on a road to somewhere. Because even trying with bad knowledge is better than, you know, just flapping around. And it just, yeah, it fascinated me so much, this idea that you put it so succinctly, so perfectly. Because, like, of course, if the horse, if you don't even know what you are asking, how on earth is the horse ever going to give you those correct answers?
Yeah, it's I find even tiny little things like riding down the road, and I'm always on a long rein. I'm sure I probably should be on the bit and doing all this sort of stuff, but anyhow, and I sometimes just decide I'm going to go like that round that drainage lid onto that darker bit of tarmac round there, and it absolutely intrigues me how little I have to do other than think. Horses are so sensitive to your thinking and the slight movement that you make, and a little bit of a neck rein here, maybe a little bit of a leg there, a little bit of a leg there, and you can get them to go exactly where you want. And really, what I love about cross country is that feeling of the horse totally understanding and trusting you, and you totally understanding and trusting him. And in a way, it's the same as walking the line on the road, but you're now in a fairly strong canter and you have to be able to go exactly where you want. And you can, and I find that fascinating. This huge half-ton of horse.
When I was a kid, I went for a lesson to you cross country, and we didn't
get... You weren't that young.
You're a kid too. and we didn't get out of walk for a long time. We were walking up and down steps, and I remember thinking, goodness, this is like this is the biggest waste of time out.
Yes,
but
it, exactly.
But it's something that I use all the time with my young horses now. And I just I'm interested to know, like, is that something that you did because you were taught to do that, or is that something you came up with yourself?
It's a very good question, because my brilliant teacher, I had two amazing teachers. I had Pat Burgess, who was a South African show jumper, married a vet, came over here, five children, just happened to teach our pony club, and I was 14 when she taught me. And Dad, who was the horseman of the family, said, she's really good. And he asked her at the end of the lesson with the pony club, will you take on Lucinda? And she just looked at him. She was the kindest person in the world. She never said boot or goose. She just said no. And Dad said, shot the Major General. Why not? Because she won't listen to me. Anyhow, thank God she did take me on. And she has been my sort of, if you have a sports psychologist, she would have been my mentors. All of my origination of understanding about weight and where the horse find it most easy for you to sit all came from her. And then we had this brilliant lady in a wheelchair, because she'd fallen, believe this or not, in a molehill out hunting, broken her back. And she was a fantastic cross-country trainer called Lady Hugh Russell. We did not do anything at walk. We didn't do much at trot. But what we did do was she tied little bits of string on all her fences, and you had to go over that bit of string and over that bit of string, and woe betide you if you didn't. And that was much more... I don't remember ever, Gemma, we were chatting about distances. I don't remember her ever saying anything about being on the right stride. The whole thing was based around the horse being absolutely on the string and having that quality of canter that enabled him to get out of anything he had to get out of. So where did the walk come from? It's a really good question. I think probably it came from wanting horses to have time, because time is the... My dad used to teach me time is the greatest healer, how right he is, or was. But having time to work out what they're doing at a ditch and what they're doing... Because there's only three things across country you have to sort out: ditches, water and banks. You'd get those three things in walk, and then you get them in trot, and then you get them in canter, and you've given your horse such a fundamental of trust. And I think it's been mentioned in the podcast that we've enjoyed before. Trust is such an important thing, and you don't just pluck it out the ceiling. And when you've had a fall, it can take a long time to actually trust again. I'll never forget the greatest rider in the world in my day, and I still have a huge respect for him, is Mark Todd. And he had a horse called Jocasta, who wasn't quite a badminton horse, but nonetheless off they went. And fence five was an elephant trap over the sodding great big ditch after Huntsman's Close. And he went absolutely arse over tip. He couldn't make it. And Toddy said to me some years later, it took him 5 years to actually feel totally trusting and confident again. But such was his strength of character, his ability, that he kept winning during those 5 years, but it took that long. And I find that hugely helpful to people I teach and to myself, that you have a bad time and it doesn't just come straight back. It takes time to build that trust and that confidence back again.
I just love listening to you. I'm sorry, I was just like, oh, my God. I was looking at Ben and he's just there like, with his mouth open, like everyone's just like, okay, just keep talking. But you bang on, not bang on, Ben, you talk with wisdom about trust all the time and that relationship and how, like, you can lose that in a second with a horse, but it is
but
about
that's
your
really
bond.
What my incredible good fortune, I mean, nobody has been as lucky as I have been, but it's been based on that one thing, because I wasn't very good. I mean, I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
Think and fucking be fair, badminton. Sing fucking, yeah.
No, be fair. I was 15 when I had Be Fair for my birthday present. All he did was rear. He was an absolutely spoiled little brat. And he went to some friends in a village, and they had a lunging rein out of the Land Rover window. The husband did, as the wife walked the horse down the village, Be Fair going mad every sweet paper, and the lunging whip, every time he spun around, he found the lunging whip. Now, believe this or not, when Owen Slott wrote a very large piece in the Times about dressage, and he rang me up and said, he actually asked me the question, what speed, he asked everybody this question, what speed was Charlotte going in a 20-mile-an-hour limit with what she did? So I thought about it, and I told him my answer. And then, as he was ringing off, he said, I think you ought to know. And he then repeated this bit of my book, Up, Up and Away, about the lingerie out the window, and somebody had told him that that was a really cruel thing to do. And I went, that is why this world is so difficult, because that was a really not a cruel thing to do. The lunging rein was out of the window so that when the horse spun round and sweep paper, he saw the lunging, not rein, sorry, the lunging whip in front of him. But that's how things get interpreted, and that really shocked me, because I'm thinking, I don't think I've got any skeletons in my cupboard, but bloody hell, if that has been interpreted like that, there's going to be a lot of them falling out. It's really quite scary, that whole sort of area.
And oh my gosh, I've just got so many questions, I don't even know where to start. Over the years, you've had huge success with so many different horses, and we literally don't have enough hours to talk about your many successes, even though you say you're shit.
But that was based on trust. Every single one of them was based on that incredible partnership.
But you...
some took years to get, and some came very quickly.
But one of the things I remember...
Go. She says she's been very lucky, but... You earn luck.
Yeah, there's no such thing as luck. It's opportunity mixed with preparation.
Yeah,
no,
it's so true.
Because you work fucking hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so many people have worked fucking hard too.
Yay! Hat trick. Excellent. So, yeah, like Gemma just said, and anyone who we didn't might not have caught your audio, she just said that you say it's luck. I've just said it's no such thing as luck. It's opportunity mixed with preparation. And you have worked incredibly hard over the years. And what I loved about, like, I obviously was putting this together and putting, and obviously hoping that you would come on it, and talking to our sponsor, Charles Owen, from the CEO of Charles Owen, who's our brilliant sponsor, Dave, he's not an equestrian. And I said, well, one of the guests I'm hoping to get is Lucinda Green. She's an absolute... And he's like, even I've heard of Lucinda Green. And, but you have done so much for the sport. And you, we are about to have the LA Olympics. And you, and that shows to me, I think, how much the sport has changed. You were the flag bearer at the LA Olympics.
Thanks you remembering that.
Well, I wasn't born. But you led out the entire British team. I feel like I don't think an equestrian will lead out. Am I right in saying this? I don't think an equestrian will ever lead out the British team again, which makes me sad. But, like... just, like, the memories of that time. Like, is there a memory you can share with us of competing at the LA Olympics or one of, like, that kind of time? There must be, like, so many stories, but what is there a standout memory from that period?
You put your finger on something that was really, really quite extraordinary. A lot of people now, because equestrianism is the first event, don't go to the opening ceremony because it's a long time standing and you're wasting away in hot sun energy that you need the next day to ride. And so quite a lot of people don't come. Anyhow, there was no choice here because I'd been given this amazing honour. And you were 2 hours, a bit like the Christian, it felt, going into the ring to be eaten by a lion, because you were underneath the stands and you heard very little. You were just shuffling along, your team behind you and another team in front and endless more behind and in front. And gradually this noise, which was the crowd cheering and roaring, you started here. If anybody's ever done white water rafting, and it's all peaceful and quiet, and then you start to hear a little noise, and it gets louder and louder as you get closer and closer until you go, whoa, over the edge. It's absolutely terrifying. But the noise, exactly like that, as you got to the entrance, it got louder and louder and louder, and then it was your turn to go up this ramp and into the main Olympic arena. And it was phenomenal. I mean, nothing could ever replace that. Although... when I had two babies, and still luckily have two babies, I have to say they put any win of badminton in the shade. They were something incredibly special on another echelon. But that Olympic flag, gosh, that was amazing.
And obviously, Lissa is a massive part of your life. One of those babies, and her
one
riding,
of those babies.
Her riding career is really it's really on the up, isn't it? And you're a massive part of her team.
I'm trying to step back because I feel if I was any good, she would have been winning everything by now. So I feel I must leave her to do her own thing, and I'm a little bit in the back sometimes to say something. I really, really admire the way she handles her horses and the way she rides cross country. She's also much better than I was at show jumping. The dressage, I'm afraid I gave her the same skill as I had myself. And she is really, with the wonderful help of Gareth Hughes, who was another fantastic...
Oh, he's amazing.
Australian. And I said, what made you take up dressage? He's such a wonderful character. And he said, do you know, I just was in the bush in Australia and I just loved describing all these shapes and movements. And he's developed that, came over from Australia with no money and developed his life that he now is Olympian top class. And he's got a really lovely affinity with Lissa, and I think she'll get it. She's so much better than she was. But it takes, and I'll never forget, Hans Gunter Winkler won 5 or 6 gold medals show jumping for the Germans, and I was sent over there for a week after I'd won my first badminton. Mike Bullen from Peden's organised it, and he put me on this warm blood liver chestnut mare. I've never ridden a warm blood in my life. We fair was sort of a little thoroughbreddy type. And he said, go and jump that course, which is about 1.15 metres. So I went and jumped that course, and I didn't know what I was doing. And as I came back alongside him, he looked at me through his glasses, and he said, what is the name of this horse that's just won badminton for you? And I was so excited that he wanted to know the name. I said, Be Fair. And he said, this horse, Be Fair, he must be some horse. And age 19 and absolutely able to be squashed flat, no problem at all. He then went on to say, the best riders in Germany go into dressage because that is the most difficult skill. And I totally agree with that. The next best, himself, into show jumping. And the riffraff go eventing. So I was put absolutely, having won badminton at 19, absolutely in my place and probably never really bounced back up again, actually.
I've heard you say that winning at 19 was almost kind of...
counterproductive.
Counterproductive, yes. Can you kind of...
And I'll tell you another. There was a very great woman who actually... Her horse sired Be Fair. He was called Fair and Square, and he won Burley for Sheila in 1969, long before you lot were born. And he was a colt, and he jumped into a thoroughbred's field and Big Gap Be Fair. And she happened to be up with Lady Hugh Russell at Wiley, where we were doing cross-country practice, and I was on Wide Awake, who I found a very, very difficult horse. And it was not long after I won badminton. Anyhow, there was a fence, a sort of corner fence, and she said, go and bounce that. So you weren't jumping the corner, you weren't jumping the one side, you jumping the bounce. And I went for the wrong upright. And he had about 2.5 yards, and inevitably he jumped in and didn't get out. And so he scrambled back up and got on and did it. And I went down to the bottom of the hill to the stables at the end, and Sheila Wilcox came up to me, who hadn't spoken to me really, and she said, Lucinda, you won badminton too early. This is a very difficult game, and spun on her heel and walked away. And she was right. I hadn't taken the trouble to get the right upright, so I'd given my horse an impossible distance, and he still kept going despite. And he actually won it himself a few years later. But that those seminal moments stick in your mind and are really what steered you. So sometimes you might feel an absolute shit for saying something to somebody. There were some kids on the underground yesterday who were about that big, and they were shouting away, and they shot onto the underground before anybody got off. You know how it's sort of polite to let everybody off first. And I thought, I'm going to say something. And I thought, no, don't say that. You'll probably get knifed. but anyhow, it's those wonderful things. And if you ever have that chance to help somebody, even if it's a bit tough, do it, because those have stuck in my mind and really shaped so much of my career. And if people have been too chicken to say it, I would never have made the good fortunes that I have.
What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think has been the toughest thing that has happened in your career?
Where shall I start? Wide Awake won badminton and died on the lap of honour. That was really tough. He got once round and he was waiting to go on his own, and the others were filing out behind me, and there was a television camera rising up on one of those automatic arms, and as it rose up, he reared. I thought he was rearing at that, but he was actually dying. And he careered around the arena with me hanging on skiing with his back end gone and his front end flying. And he got all the way, I mean, I don't know how he didn't crash into trees and jumps, but he got back to where he started and he was dead. that he'd been dead all the time. So that was pretty shocking, because that's... So from winning badminton, within 5 minutes, your horse is dead.
Because when you told me that story and you said you were in the you were driving home and you heard about it on the radio...
No, that was Befer, his first win.
Yeah,
that was extraordinary, because he did win it when I was 19. And I switched the radio on my little two-horse box with my little horse literally with his head over here and was about to sort of drive out. And I switched on, I don't know, 5 o'clock news. And in those days, it told you who'd won badminton. Yeah. Doesn't do it anymore. And I just went... That's you. it was just unbelievable. And then that Befer, whom I'd had from age of 15, a birthday present. I remember I still have the telegram saying, "Happy birthday, Mum, Dad, Befer." And that was when I knew.
I've seen the telegram. Mine. You've got it in a book next to your Pony Club C test.
Which I have to say, I failed the riding.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't do a turn on whichever hand it was. Luckily, the stable management got me through. But then that wonderful horse, he'd really been my total love affair from 15 onwards. Whereas competing in Montreal, which was tricky course, and quite deep ground, and it was in the foothills of the mountains. And he came around the turn to the finish... And something didn't feel right, but it was only about 30 yards to the finish. And when he got through the finish, he pulled up and he was absolutely crippled behind. But it was worse than that, because he was kicking really, really hard. And I thought, something terrible's happened. He's going to have to be shot. And that's all I could think of, because if you've ever seen an Achilles tendon come off a hock, they panic. And they, not always, I'm sure, but I've seen several of them, and they, thank God, not mine, they kick absolutely so hard. And so we somehow had to get him up to the stables. He had to be given a tranquilizer. And I had no idea what had happened. And our wonderful vet said he slipped the Achilles tendon off his hock, and that was coming round the finish. And at that point, he was in silver medal position. But that so didn't matter, because that was my wonderful horse who had gone. So he stayed alive, and he came back, and he did a couple of events, but he was never sound behind. And he hunted, and he loved that. And I was on him the day that... I followed Barry Hills, a racehorse trainer, over a fucking enormous hedge, and I didn't put any welly into it because Barry was going so slowly, and he came down so steep, and I heard a bang, and that was the front tendon, and it was the opposite one to the Achilles tendon. So we kept him at home in the field as comfortably as we could, but it was obvious that this was an injury that he didn't need to have to live with and that he needed to go to heaven. And so I went to Australia to teach, and Mum did the business, and it was her last link with Dad, who died the year before, so it was all frightfully traumatic. But that's, I'm sure all of you here who are totally involved with your horses, and my mind goes to you, Gemma, with your boy, and he did something very sudden for you, and that is what we have to live with. We love them so much that the finishing bit can be an absolute bloody nightmare, but we have to just keep going and get a bit tougher.
Oh, you're going to set me off. Oh, Gemma's got some welling. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, golly.
That's the thing, isn't it? Well, this is the thing, one of the reasons we do this podcast, and that it's always the hashtag I add on social media. Sorry, I am on social media, Austin. But it is, it's hashtag love of the horse, and we do this, all of us do it, because... No one, and I've said it before, no one who's ever done anything wrong or anything in the equestrian world, you don't start riding because you don't like horses. It's not a sport you get into.
They're in tears.
Oh, they're in tears. You're making people cry.
Sorry.
You don't start riding because you don't love horses. No, everyone has this in... We might get lost along the way on the journey, or pressure of competition might get in the way, or like the need to fund your sport or whatever. But fundamentally, you do it. You don't get up at stupid o'clock in the morning to muck out and ride in the pissing rain and cold. But it is just the love of the horse, isn't it?
And the sad thing is, the people that are so determined that we're cruel and we don't have welfare in the front of our minds will never know the depth of that love. And there's no way we can explain it to them, because until you feel it, you're just going to think, oh, yeah, that's what they all say. And it's really, I find that the hardest thing at the moment in this modern world is... You just don't know that relationship, and it is such an incredible relationship. Mm. When it comes to fruition, it can be jolly tough along the way, don't we know? I've just been on safari in Africa, hence the peely nose, and the second week I had a little chestnut mare. He was about 8 or 9. Now, there was something golden about this horse. She was clever with her feet and brave and wanting to go, and she was all the lovely things that I love. But there was something absolutely golden, and I kept saying, why do I know this horse is so kind? And I can't still explain what was the vibe that was coming up. That, and I'd just ridden a very nice mare before her, but I didn't have those vibes at all from her. She was perfectly good and brave and everything else, but this one was so kind. And it's that kindness that you fall into place with, and that, I think, sort of spins you along the way. And it's difficult, because not every horse is kind, but if you find one that is a bit like a man, actually, my mum said, marry a kind man. What?
Are you kind?
Anyhow, we could go off at a tangent on that one, but it's just it's a wonderful feeling when you have a horse between your legs.
Or a man off. Between your legs.
No, we're not right there. You feel this tremendous give. And it's that give that you worship, and that's what you want to take with you through all these vicarage fees. I agree with you, Gemma. The worst fence in the world, the most difficult, is the vicarage fee. Oh, so agree with you.
It's just, you are so good at reading horses, though. Would you say that about yourself?
Do you know, when I was little, all I wanted to do was be able to ride every horse I sat on and be able to feel how to ride. I never got there. But it's sort of transferred, and I still haven't got there, into teaching, so that you see a horse and you think, well, I think that's a bit like this, or that's a bit like that. So although I haven't been able to do it riding, and some people are just geniuses, and they get on any horse and they know exactly how it's going to feel. And can translate it. I'd like to feel I can do it a little bit teaching, but there's still masses of horses. I'm really sorry you've just wasted your money, because I really don't know how to help you. I've got to tell you one story, then I promise I'm shutting up, because you'll love this. So this is Boyd Martin. He's one of the great riders of the world, come from Australia, become American. Sits at my feet at the Babington 5 years ago, maybe four. Because he thinks I know what I'm talking about, I suppose. And he's watching this bloody vicarage fee. And I'm saying, you don't want to be hooking into that, no. Boyd. You want to get your line and you just want to ride. And I promise you, it's a big enough fence, the horses will find their spot. Anyhow, he did what I said. And two, three strides out, he went, fuck, I can't see one. And he pulled and he fell over tip into the ditch, and I got full blame. To the point that Ian Stark, who's a great friend of mine, said to me at Burley X months later, he said, you simply got to realise, Lucinda, that some people have to see a stride. They cannot just come into the Vicarage V moving. And I absolutely saluted him, because you would bear that out, Gemma. That was my way of doing it. It absolutely didn't work with him. And then I later saw his wife at Burley, and she said, oh, God, don't talk to Boyd before the cross-country, will you? So I got 100% the blame, but I knew you'd enjoy that story, because it's the different ways of doing things. It was the only way I knew. I remember exactly the post where the roping was, and I came off the third post and just aimed for that sodding oak tree over there, which I think's probably come down now, and just kept riding, kept sitting behind, and the only horse that did land in the bottom of the ditch and jump straight out again was Kildare, because I was so frightened. I remember you saying that you screamed, and you were only screaming at yourself. I was so frightened of the bloody thing that I lifted my whip just to do that, and that horse, Kildare, who was the only horse who ever been first, second and third at Bampton, could not stand the whip. Born and bred in Ireland, couldn't stand the whip. And as I did it, and he leapt into the air, he turned left. And I went, you stupid cow. I had all that time to see what was going to happen, that he turned from the angle over the oak tree, turned left, was going down, down, down into what was then a sewer. And it was this deep in sewage. And I thought, you can imagine, you've enough time when something like that's happened to you. Stupid bloody cow, why did you let that happen? You know he can't stand the whip. Anyhow, he jumped down into the sewer, and he jumped clean out again up the bank, galloped on and won it. I mean... I mean, that's what I mean about being lucky. Oh, my golly.
I don't care if all our food is getting cold, quite frankly.
I just, they're okay, good. Like, there's so many amazing riders in this room and so many people who just love the horse. If you have one, is there one bit of wisdom you live by? Is there something that just you go back to all the time? Is there something you can end our podcast on that we can take away?
Yeah, my dad.
Yeah.
Came and patted me on the knee before I set out for my first badminton. He said, don't forget, old girl, you do it for fun.
Yeah.
Never has anything felt less fun. And he did the same thing at the European Championships when I had to go clear, and I was on quite one of the worst jumpers ever. And just patted me on the ear, said, don't forget why you do it. You do it for fun. But actually, it's a genius thing to remember. It was my way of defusing. And the other thing, I've never, and this is interesting, Gemma, because this is where, again, we're very different. I have never set out to win because I can't bear the disappointment of failing. So I always set out to do the very best I could. In the Olympic Games, I was hot favourite, Los Angeles, and I came sixth. And there were so many people saying, I'm so sorry. I said, don't be sorry. Regal Realm, well, as well as you could possibly go, and for once I didn't fuck it up. And there were just five others better than us on the day. And that is how it is. And Richard Mead, who was a great mate and was a mentor right the way through, as he was that sort of half generation older, he simply didn't believe it. We were talking about what spurred you on to win, and he simply didn't believe that I don't go out there and say I'm going to win. I just couldn't handle that pressure. It was, I'm going to do my very best if I possibly can. And you can't always. mess it up.
And we speak about this all the time on the podcast, don't we? I was like, poor Simon, on paper, like at badminton, you went round really slow. And like, to the people who don't understand about horses, it looked like you did shit.
So pleased.
But he knows that like Freddie was like fucking brilliant at Poe and went round clear and put loads of demons to bed. But I mean, it's... He does always look so pretty. Not just on a horse, either. But that is the thing with this...
She's coming back.
I'm coming back. I'm going somewhere with this. But we talk about it all the time, isn't it? This is a sport where it's not necessarily the first, second, or winning the hoof pick at Tweedledown. It is about like your own person... You've got to keep your own personal goals with that horse in that moment of time in mind all the time.
Absolutely, I totally agree. Well, obviously, like... just to get around a 5-star for me, clear, even if it is with 86 time faults.
Oh, amazing.
I was the slowest round Burley 2 years on the trot. Slowest finisher round Burley 2 years on the trot.
And so. Plenty of others didn't finish.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I would love to keep going, but I think this wonderful... The tavern here at the Ligon Arms might actually hate us forever if we keep going. Because, Lucinda, I get emotional speaking to you because I just love you so much. You literally, every message I get, I either piss myself laughing or cry a little bit because you're so bloody beautiful. You give so much to so many, and I hope you know that. And thank you so much. I hope, can you come back on the podcast?
No,
as well?
I'd love to, but
thank you very
they've
much.
All heard it now.
We've got a little present for you. Thank you so much to Charles Owen for sponsoring our podcast and taking a risk on us, where they contacted us and they take a risk on us. Thank you all, you guys.
Just before we all go, I just want to... I've got a little something for Jenny.
No, don't you go. Get back here.
Thank you very much. Everything you've done. We've had a great time.
What have you done? What have you done wrong?
Yes, what have they done wrong?
Oh, the work is going.
He's left the prize.
He's left the... Yeah, no, don't... I ripped it off. Thank you. But Ben, Simon, you've come on this crazy mad adventure and it's been brilliant. You guys, you didn't have to answer your messages. You do it better than Ben, to be fair. Thank you very much. And you didn't, like... I appreciate this. We're not going to be everyone's cup of tea. We're swearing. It's a little bit different. Thank you for coming on this journey. And I'm just going to say it again. Lucinda Green, shut up and ride. You're my fucking hero.